Breathe deep.
Expand your mind. And let the music be your driving force.
Enter a world of...
And it's 11 o'clock here in New York City at 99.5. FM WBAI, yes it is, and WBAI.org on web. Coming up next, Code Pink Radio. New York, and streaming live at www.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Danny Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say code war.
We say code pink.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say code war.
We say code pink.
Code pink for freedom. Code pink for peace. Code pink when hunger and war have ceased.
Code pink for women, boys, men, and women.
That was Emma's Revolution, and I'm Marcy Winograd, coordinator of Code Pink Congress, a campaign to mobilize congressional support for a new foreign policy, one that is rooted in diplomacy, not war. Thank you for joining us on Code Pink Radio, broadcast on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM in New York City and WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. Code Pink is an international women's-led anti-war organization working to reduce the U.S. military budget, disinvest pension retirement funds from military contractors, reject U.S. global domination, abolish nuclear weapons, and support progressive movements throughout the world. Today on Code Pink Radio, we'll talk about abolishing the Selective Service, registration for a future draft, as well as challenges to the Biden administration's plans to produce new nuclear weapons. First, here's what's happening at Code Pink. We've raised $400,000 for syringes to be sent to Cuba, the target of a cruel 60-year U.S. embargo, made worse under Trump, who imposed an additional 200 sanctions on Cuba, including a prohibition against families in the United States sending money, dollars, hard currency to relatives in Cuba. This embargo is tantamount to war on Cuba, war made invisible to us in the United States. Unfortunately, the Biden administration has kept those onerous sanctions in place. So even though Cuba has developed 5 vaccines for COVID, it lacks the syringes and other medical supplies needed to stem the pandemic. Why do we still have the Cuba embargo? All eyes are on Florida and the Senate race to oust Republican Marco Rubio. Calling all progressives, somebody, sign up, volunteer to run in that race. Good news out of Burlington, Vermont. Our Code Pink Divest team, led by Carly Town, was successful in motivating the Burlington City Council to pass a resolution to divest the city from weapons manufacturers. For the record, the top 5 weapons contractors are General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. I think, however, Vermont's Senator Patrick Leahy missed the memo, because Leahy is pushing for another $1 billion for the Pentagon in upcoming legislation. Leahy is a big deal. He's chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, which works up the budget for the Department of Defense. Biden's military budget, a record high $753 billion, includes a down payment on a near $2 trillion price tag to produce new nuclear weapons over several decades. One hopeful sign, House appropriators, those who budget money for our military, are cutting funds for the Navy's ship-launched nuclear cruise missile, a weapon that can carry both conventional and nuclear warheads, which makes it even more dangerous, more likely to be used, and more likely to confuse an adversary. Code Pink and other anti-war groups have talked to members of Congress to resist this new nuclear weapon, and some are heeding the call. The fight over that sea-launched cruise missile is not over yet, however. We need to urge our U.S. senators to co-sponsor key anti-nuclear weapons bills to stop nuclear rearmament. Got a pen? Here are the bill numbers. S is in Senate, S-595, the Nuclear SLCM Ban Act of 2021, S-1862, a bill to reduce spending on nuclear weapons and related defense spending, and to prohibit the procurement and deployment of low-yield nuclear warheads and for other purposes. S-982, a bill to scrap the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, or GBSD. This nuclear rearmament program would replace 400 Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missiles, they call them ICBMs, in Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, and Nebraska, with 600 new underground ICBMs. Please call and write your U.S. senators. Tell them to support these bills, to co-sponsor S-595, S-1862, and S-982. In the 1980s, we had a mass anti-nuclear movement. We need another one. Help Code Pink build opposition to the nuclear rearmament plan, drafted under Obama, funded in part by Trump, and now supported by Biden. Meanwhile, a coalition has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Energy in an effort to stop the production of the new warhead, the new nuclear warhead for the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent. The coalition includes Tri-Valley Cares, based in Livermore, California, Nuclear Watch New Mexico near Los Alamos Lab, Savannah River Site Watch in Columbia, South Carolina, and the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition in Gullah Geechee, South Carolina. I spoke with the executive director of Tri-Valley Cares about the issues in the lawsuit over ramped-up production of plutonium pits or nuclear bomb cores. Here's the interview with Marilia Kelly. Great to have you with us, Marilia. Tell me about the lawsuit, the purpose of the lawsuit, what you're asking for.
Absolutely. The lawsuit is being brought by four organizations, Tri-Valley Cares, my organization here in Livermore, California, Nuclear Watch New Mexico in New Mexico, Savannah River Site Watch in South Carolina, and also with Queen Kwet, who is the head of the Gullah Geechee Nation and also has founded a nonprofit environmental group that as such is a party in the lawsuit. And our attorneys are with the South Carolina Environmental Law Project, or SCELP. And together, what we are demanding is a full programmatic, that is nationwide, analysis of the environmental and other negative impacts of expanding plutonium pit production at two sites, expanding the production at the Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico up to 30 pits or more a year, and actually founding an entirely new program at the Savannah River site in South Carolina, where they've never done any plutonium pits before, to do 50 or more a year for a total of 80 or more per year. The current authorization under the National Environmental Policy Act is simply for Los Alamos to do 20 or fewer a year. And the most that Los Alamos has ever done a year is 11. So that gives you an idea of what the country's quote unquote needs are for new plutonium pits. It's between 0 and 11. And that brings me to why California is such a key partner in this attempt to get this full programmatic review. First of all, for at least the first 8 years of expanded pit production at two locations, all of the pits at both locations would serve a Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory new design warhead that's being designed with novel pits that requires pit production. And that's called the W87-1, and that's intended to sit atop the new GBSD, or Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent Missile. It is a reasonable alternative under the law, under NEPA, as well as more broadly. It is a reasonable alternative not to design a new warhead that requires new pits. There are no warheads in the stockpile right now for which any pit production is scheduled. There are no warheads undergoing a more simple refurbishment for which any pit production is scheduled. It's all to serve new warheads. So one of the goals is to force a discussion about reasonable alternatives and about foregoing new warhead designs that require new pit production. Additionally, Tri-Valley Cares is involved in California is important because all of the impacts are not going to be just at those two sites. For example, there's a little note in the bottom of a table that says Los Alamos is going to send, this is plutonium pit material, to Livermore Lab here in California in the Bay Area, 1,100 miles away from New Mexico, to do something called material testing. The little citation does not say what materials testing is. I mean, I know what it is generally, and it's very hazardous and dangerous, but there's no explanation of that. Nor is there anything that tells you how big or small these samples are going to be. Nor is there anything that tells you how they're going to be transported from Los Alamos to Livermore. Nor is there anything that tells you how often. And remember, if you look at a map and the approved transportation routes, this material is basically going through very populated areas, including the greater Los Angeles area, up through other populated areas and into the very populated Bay Area. And so these are all questions that communities deserve to have answers. And this one question about Livermore is only one of the many questions. There's the issue of transportation of plutonium, both in terms of the pits and the material to different sites, including Livermore. There's also the question of waste. Where does that waste go? The National Nuclear Security Administration is making an assumption they can just send it to the WIP facility, which is the only facility in the U.S. that accepts transuranic that is contaminated with plutonium waste. But that facility is oversubscribed. The Department of Energy and NNSA have so many streams that they say are going to WIP. It's more than WIP can handle. And WIP's is supposed to close. So they're assuming they can get a permit modification to do a whole lot of things. These assumptions, you would think, should be analyzed in advance. Alternatives should be considered in advance. Mitigation measures to lower the risk to workers and the public, to reduce transportation hazards, to reduce operational hazards. You would think those should be analyzed program-wide, nationally, in the beginning before they create this huge national program that involves production at two sites, involves seven other locations across the country in their parts of expanded pit production, involves transportation between them, probably quite busily, so that big truck on the freeway next to your car with your kids may have plutonium from this program, and they have never analyzed what those risks might be or how they're going to do that transport as safely as possible. And then there's the whole question of all of the wastes. I mean, what if they don't get these permit modifications at WIP? And by the way, the people in New Mexico deserve not to have them get these permit modifications to increase hazards there. Then does the plutonium sit at these sites? I mean, what happens to it? Under what conditions will it end up? All of that has not been analyzed. All of those questions are still big question marks. I should be able to tell you the answer. This is what the program is. The Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration wants to implement the program without having to answer those questions. It also wants to implement the program without having any public hearings at any of these other sites. So people who live there have no idea that their community is actually downwind and downstream of expanded pit production activity. That's wrong. So therefore, we're suing them.
Mary Lee, you are with Tri-Valley Cares. You are part of a coalition, as you mentioned, suing the Department of Energy over this plan to ramp up plutonium pit production for a warhead that would be used in new ICBM missiles planted underground in states such as North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, and Nebraska, 600 of these new ICBM missiles. What is the risk to not having a comprehensive environmental assessment? The Department of Energy would say, well, we did a public comment period and we produced an environmental impact statement for ramped up pit production in New Mexico or in Savannah River, South Carolina. So we don't need another one.
So let me correct slightly. There's been no environmental impact statement to production at Los Alamos Lab. They did a very low level supplement analysis and decided they didn't need to do one, a bad decision to start with. And the one they did at the Savannah River site, the title of it even says it's an analysis of using what had been under construction to do mixed oxide plutonium fuel for power plants to do plutonium bomb production inside, which is a very different activity. And so it's limited to basically that site and focused on that particular conversion and activity. So that leaves all these other questions that I just mentioned completely unexamined as well as unanswered. And that's the hazard. The hazard is that they're going forward, if I can make a little play on words, haphazardly. And this creates harms to workers who will be the first people to be exposed when there are accidents, leaks, and spills and things happen that hadn't been analyzed. So there are no mitigation measures. You don't have to have a mitigation measure if you don't analyze it, right? So workers are going to be at risk. The public is going to be at risk. As I live, I'm coming to you from my house this morning. I live less than 6 miles from Livermore Lab. The Tri-Valley Cares office is less than 2 miles from Livermore Lab. The nearest home is a few hundred yards. So we are talking about potential public exposures. And then we get into the question about what happens with the waste and waste production and waste handling that hasn't been looked at. And then we get into the question of transportation that hasn't been looked at. And then we have that open question of how much activity is going to occur at these 7 other sites that the government admits are going to be part of it, but never looked at.
What are those sites? What are the 7 others?
Okay.
Or a few of them. Not quiz.
The top of my head. I already mentioned the WIP. A dump site in New Mexico has never been the subject of any detailed analysis. Livermore Lab, where I am, is going to get plutonium pit material. They're buying new glove boxes for this plutonium pit material that's never been analyzed. The Kansas City plant that does the non-nuclear production but also integrates everything with the pits has a role that has not been analyzed. The Pantex plant, where all assembly and disassembly of nuclear weapons takes place, particularly the initial steps, that is going to be hugely impacted, just using one's logic, never been analyzed at all. The Y-12 facility in Tennessee that concentrates on secondaries but has this role in marrying the plutonium pit to the H-bomb part of the secondary, that's listed as having some role, but it is undescribed and therefore unknown. And then there's the Sandia lab that takes the warheads that Livermore designs. There's a Sandia in Livermore, California, and the one in Albuquerque, New Mexico, takes the designs that Los Alamos completes and does the work to quote unquote marry them to their delivery vehicle. that's listed as being affected, but we don't know how or how much. So the number one issue that I have is the fact that these things are unexamined. They should not be questions. And these communities, including mine, all deserve to have a public hearing that would happen if there's a programmatic environmental impact statement, and has not happened because there is not one.
I'm Marcy Winograd with Code Pink Radio, interviewing Maralia Kelly with the Tri-Valley Cares, the executive director. They have joined a coalition to file a lawsuit against the Department of Energy over plans to ramp up pit production. That's plutonium pit production, the core of the nuclear warhead, without, as the lawsuit alleges, without a comprehensive environmental assessment of how all of this will come together. Although there are two sites principally involved, there are several others involved as well. Let's focus on the issue of nuclear waste for a minute, Maralia, because a lot of people are not aware of the fact that, for example, you said the waste storage facility in New Mexico is at capacity or oversubscribed and is planning to shut down, and I believe in 2024. What are the issues with nuclear waste in this country, and what are we getting ourselves into by replacing these nuclear missiles in North Dakota and Wyoming and so forth with 600 new ICBMs?
With new design, with novel features. There's no good that comes of that. We're talking specifically about the litigation and the pits and the environmental impacts, but it's all to serve a purpose that in fact promotes nuclear proliferation by us having brand new designs with brand new and different military features, basically threatening the world. So, and for those who live in those states, another consideration is that in Department of Energy and Defense Department parlance, that's considered the nuclear sponge. The idea is that the opponent country will have to use so many of its nuclear weapons to hit our weapons in the silos. They'll have fewer nuclear weapons to go after our submarines and planes, which are more invulnerable, especially our submarines. So if you live in the Midwest, you're considered disposable, to be quite frank. Setting those policy questions aside, as important as they are, and just focusing on, you know, what would happen if we didn't do this, which I think was your question.
What about waste? You know, what are the implications of the waste?
So what would happen if we didn't do this is we wouldn't be producing fresh waste. And the only way to properly manage nuclear waste is to try to deal with that which has already been produced. You cannot adequately manage plutonium contaminated waste while you're continuing to produce more and more. And this would be a huge waste producer, as you could imagine. I mean, and so in terms of sending it all to New Mexico, I think what the Department of Energy National Nuclear Security Administration is banking on is if they oversubscribe WIP, that they can override the state of New Mexico's objections. They can override their current permit limits, and they can just, you know, wave the wand that says national security, we get to do what we down please. And suddenly, you know, WIP really is the dump site for the nation and for all the new ways. And to help your listeners and viewers understand what we're talking about with plutonium contaminated waste, let me just throw out one fact. So we're talking about the weapons grade isotope of plutonium, which is plutonium-239. It has a half-life, meaning half of it will have decayed in 24,000 years. A hazardous life is considered, as a rule of thumb, as 10 half-lives, because remember, half decays and then half and then half and then half. That's 240,000 years. That's longer than recorded human history. That's longer than, it's a time frame we can't imagine. As someone who loves literature and Greek plays and the humanities, I've always thought that creating plutonium, and which is done in a reactor, by the way, creating plutonium and plutonium waste is the modern day definition of the old Greek word hubris. And you remember what happened in the old Greek plays to the protagonist that had too much hubris. And that's a really good situation here. We have small disasters every day. We have people dying every day, workers and members of the public. We have people getting sickened by this every day. There are tens of thousands of former employees and current employees of the Department of Energy who've put in applications to try to get compensation for their fatal illnesses that they believe were caused by their work exposures. Members of the public, we have certain programs for them, but not for the public around the site. So we just get sick and die. That's what's at stake.
Well, we don't want that to happen. So let's project a little bit into the future, Marilia. It's now September. The House and Senate have returned from their August recesses. They are going to work on the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which clarifies how money and the military budget should be spent. What can people do to challenge this plan for ramped up plutonium pit production for 600 new ICBM missiles?
So I want to first say that anything that anybody does is part of the movement to prevent this and have a much more safe and sane future. So if you're inclined to write a letter to the editor, gather some information from, you know, the Code Pink website, the Tri-Valley Cares website, do that. If you're inclined to, and I want to encourage all action, including talking to your members of Congress. There are three things that it takes to do nuclear weapons, just really fundamentally. It takes people, and they have the people in place. It takes nuclear material. The United States has produced all these nuclear materials, and it takes money. According to the Constitution, Congress holds the purse strings. If you stop the money, you stop the program. So it's absolutely essential that in the circle of who we talk to about this, that we include our members of Congress. There are two places that this can be affected. In particular, one you mentioned, which is the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee will do what's called the National Defense Authorization Act. They could change the authorization for the number of pits. Right now it says 80 or more. They could change that to 20 or more, which is its current limit under the National Environmental Policy Act. So changing the number of pits that are authorized is huge in stopping this program. The other thing that happens is the money that's authorized in the House and Senate Armed Services Committee, but it's actually appropriated through the Appropriations Committee and particularly the Energy and Water Subcommittee of Appropriations. And they can be asked just flat out to cut the funding. That is really important. If funding is not cut and authorization is not changed, the Department of Energy National Nuclear Security Administration is banking on getting the horse of expanded pit production too far out of the barn before they have to do any environmental review. A court process is never a quick process. And your opponent can always ask for extensions. So it's absolutely imperative that Congress asks, that Congress acts. They don't have to ask, they have to act. That Congress acts to cut the money and the authorization. And that will at least slow things down in such a way that it becomes possible for the government to take this hard look at the program that we're asking. And frankly, if we can force them to take a hard look and force them to do public hearings across the country, and create a sort of a referendum on this proposal publicly, we can get them to change the proposal. So having the Congress slow this down is absolutely essential to getting the kind of change we need.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Marilia Kelly of the Tri-Valley Cares organization, part of a coalition suing the Department of Energy for not producing a comprehensive programmatic environmental assessment of ramped up plutonium pit production for these new ICBM missiles. Been a great pleasure to talk to you, and we certainly will be mobilizing our supporters to contact their Congress members and to cut off the funds, the authorizations for this program. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Kim and John, and I learned self-trade, made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag, then wondering how he got this far. Another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the moon with land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now and he's still there, chasing ghosts in thin dry air. Meanwhile back at home, the fine has come in.
I'm Marcy Winograd on Code Pink Radio. Today, we'll also talk about abolishing the Selective Service registration for a future draft. Some in Congress want to expand the Selective Service to require women who are often sexually harassed or assaulted in the military to also register when they turn 18. This is not feminism. This is not about equal rights. As writer and anti-war activist Rivera Sun will tell you, Rivera is the editor of Nonviolence News and part of this network working to abolish the military draft system for people of all genders. Recently, Rivera joined us on Code Pink Congress to talk about legislation moving through Congress to expand Selective Service to include women, as well as bills to abolish Selective Service altogether.
So I grew up hearing stories about my dad as a conscientious objector, as an anti-Vietnam War organizer, as someone who helped people flee the country when they were drafted. And so when I heard that the Congress was thinking about drafting young women, I stood up very boldly and said, this is wrong. It's completely wrong. Now, the cool thing is that they have a choice. Congress doesn't have to draft young women, and they don't have to keep drafting young men. There is a bipartisan bill that has been introduced in the House and in the Senate that calls for the repeal of the entire Selective Service system. And it's being supported by feminists like myself, anti-war advocates, people who oppose militarism, and then people who maybe don't care about any of those things, but think it's a good example of wasteful government spending. Because even the former head of the Selective Service said that this is an outdated and wasteful system that is not doing its job. When we think about what gender justice would look like around this issue, the only just answer is to repeal the Selective Service for all genders. If we think of this in terms of what the draft actually is, which is involuntary conscription into the military. basically involuntary servitude, which is another word for slavery. And we've already had this conversation in the United States. It wouldn't make it right to enslave yet another group of people in addition to African Americans in slavery times, right? It doesn't make it more just to subject yet another group to an injustice. The way we find justice is to liberate both groups from the threat of this injustice. So this is, it seems very logical to me. I hope it seems logical to you. But apparently it doesn't sound very logical to pro-war feminists who have been trying to advance the military draft. That's why we need you to call your Congress members and explain this to them very nicely, that they have a great out. Nobody really wants to expand the draft to women. They're all kind of tiptoeing around it. They're trying to avoid it. Nobody really wants to like spearhead this charge because they know that both the feminists will get on their case, the peace activists like us will get on their case, and the sexists who don't think women can do anything will get on their case. But they need to know there is an out and that they can repeal the Selective Service and that this is actually the best historic moment for them to do so when the pressure is on them to create gender justice and when we don't really need a draft. We haven't had an active draft since Vietnam. We don't really need to use it in the wars that we're fighting. And if you're here for Code Pink, then you already know that we don't want to give them an endless cannon fodder credit card to subject young people's bodies to expanding and fighting their already obscene wars. So the other point to consider, and this comes up a lot, and so I'm just going to bring it right up, is that many times when I'm talking about why it's time to abolish the Selective Service, people start to say, well, doesn't that put an unfair burden on poor people and people of color who are already subjected to the poverty draft? Wouldn't it be better to draft everyone? And then, you know, everyone supposedly equally serves. This is yet another one of those examples of false logic. The way to solve the poverty draft problem is not to draft all young people against their will. The way to solve it is to make affordable college education or a jobs guarantee opportunities for people in that regard so that nobody is signing up for the military to simply get a college education or employment. We think it's really important that we take advantage of this moment when Congress needs to make a decision about this. It could dance around it for another 10 years, but they're probably going to make a decision. They've already put some hints that they're going to roll the expansion of the draft into the next NDAA. We're trying to stop that. But your Congress people need to hear from you because they need to know that women especially, and young women especially, and those who are feminists of other genders, are really clear that feminism, which has historically stood up for the rights of men as well as women, for gender equality, not just women over men, but for men and women and people defining gender differently, to share equality, says that the way we're going to resolve this situation, according to feminism, is to end the draft system for everyone.
Rivera Sun, author and activist working to abolish the Selective Service system. Rivera referred to legislation in Congress, so let's take a look at bills we can ask our Congress members to co-sponsor. If you do not know who your congressperson is, find out. Ask a friend. Look online. At Code Pink Congress, we want activists to become organizers. Arrange meetings with representatives. Organize rallies. Apply street heat. And build coalitions around key demands for demilitarization at home and abroad. Ask yourself, what organization or organizations am I working with to advance a progressive foreign policy? If you can't name an organization, join one. Because if you're not part of an organization, you are not organizing. To join Code Pink, just sign up at our website, codepink.org. To join Code Pink Congress, go to codepink.org/ Code Pink Congress. Now, back to the bills we want to support to abolish the Selective Service. Got a pen or pencil? Here are the bill numbers. In the House, we want our representatives to co-sponsor H.R. 2509, H.R. 2509 to repeal Selective Service. In the Senate, we want our senators to co-sponsor S. 1139, which also repeals Selective Service. Under U.S. law, if you're male, as assigned at birth, and a U.S. citizen or immigrant non-citizen, you are legally required to register with the Selective Service system within 30 days of turning 18. What's the purpose? The purpose is for the Pentagon to have a ready supply of bodies to fight a future war for oil or empire or both. The government hasn't actually had a draft in place since the 1970s. That was during the Vietnam War. And it's been decades since the government prosecuted anyone for not registering for Selective Service. So the government instead enforces registration through a series of backdoor channels. For example, if a man fails to register for Selective Service, he can become ineligible for most federal jobs. And many states require registration as a condition for state student loans, state jobs, even a driver's license. Other states go so far as to automatically register any man between the ages of 18 and 25 when he applies for a driver's license, learner's permit, or non-driver identification. Another supporter of abolishing Selective Service is Ed Hasbrouck, who spent 4 months in a federal prison camp for refusing to register for Selective Service.
Keeping the draft in the arsenal of policy options is not because they can come up with any plausible scenario. When the National Commission was questioning me, the best scenario they could come up with for when they would want a draft was, suppose we're being invaded simultaneously from Mexico and Canada and there aren't enough volunteers to defend the country. It's not realistic, but it's not about actual wanting a draft. It's wanting to be able to plan for war without limits. Just the very, it's the idea of putting any constraint that's the problem for them.
That was Ed Hasbrouck, a member of the War Resisters League and the Military Law Task Force of the National Lawyers Guild. Some in Congress support legislation to require women to register for Selective Service when they turn 18. We put the question of requiring women to register to the president of Veterans for Peace. Adrian Kinney served in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves from 1994 through 2004 as an Arabic linguist in military intelligence. She was activated in the reserves for 2 years following the events of 9/11 and served stateside on operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. She later served as the New England Regional Coordinator for Iraq Veterans Against the War. Here's what Adrian Kinney had to say about legislation to require young women to also register for Selective Service.
How dare anybody force anybody to register, to take part in a system where military sexual trauma, sexual harassment, and rape is not only incredibly common, that despite decades-long no tolerance, commands are still reluctant to pursue people who have been accused of sexual harassment and rape, and retaliation is at all-time high, despite the fact that the military has, over the past 20 years, said that they are doing everything they can.
supports our effort to rethink this system and professionalize the way the military handles these cases.
Among those who testified at Senator Gillibrand's hearing was Amy Frank, a civilian who works for the U.S. Army advocating for victims of sexual assault in the military. Frank says she was retaliated against for her advocacy for women in the military who were raped by other members of the U.S. military.
I have been left in this suspension after protecting my victims and reporting the command for over 16 months, completely ostracized and retaliated against. This evidence was reported to the Office of Special Counsel and the DOD IG. The Army's internal 15-6 process has impeded justice for my victims and myself. This internal investigative process does not allow for transparency and should be abolished. My whistleblower complaint was due to a 17-year-old private in the Granite City, Illinois Reserve Center that was raped, resulting in a broken collarbone and a broken arm. She had to stand next to her assailant in formation. The command's illegal 15-6 investigation was documented in a memorandum for record. They said it was consensual sex. For over a year, no one assisted her until I was notified in June of 2019. But after my suspension, her advocacy ended. Advocates are continually blocked by layers of command from protecting their victims. When commanders ignore advice of advocates, we have no recourse. There are no consequences for commanders when they violate the law, documented by the number of murders and murders by suicide. Nicole Burnham's brigade commander, Colonel John Munford, left Nicole in the same barracks at Camp Casey with her offenders, raped and later gang raped, tortured for over 82 days before her transfer was executed. Nicole Burnham is dead. Staff Sergeant Morgan Robinson's first offender is still serving in the Oklahoma Army National Guard. Staff Sergeant Robinson's report of 9 Special Forces soldiers placing a covering over her head, dragging her out of a tent, and gang raping her in Afghanistan has never been investigated.
Amy Frank, now on suspension for her advocacy on behalf of victims of sexual assault. Earlier this year, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin ordered the establishment of an independent commission to review the problem of sexual assault in the military. The panel recommended removing investigations of sexual harassment and rape from the chain of command. But according to the New York Times, legislation to do so is continually blocked by 2 men in the Senate. Rhode Island Democrat Jack Reed, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Oklahoma's Jim Inhofe, the ranking Republican member of that committee. Give them a call, Reed and Inhofe. Tell them what you think. Here's the number for the Congressional Switchboard. 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. That brings our show on Code Pink Radio to a close. I want to thank our guests, Marilia Kelly of Tri-Valley Cares, part of a coalition suing the Department of Energy over ramped-up production of nuclear bomb cores. I also want to thank Rivera's son, Ed Hasbrook, and Adrian Kinney, our guests, who appeared on Code Pink Congress earlier and are working to abolish the Selective Service and expose the rampant problem of sexual assault in the military. I'm Marcy Winograd for Code Pink Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. Thank you for listening, for caring, and for organizing for peace with justice.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link. They say Cold War.
Code Pink.
It's blood for oil. We know there's a link.
They say Cold War.
We say Cold War.
for WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. A Florida judge said yesterday that victims and families who suffered losses from the Champlain Tower South condo collapse will get a minimum of $150 million in compensation. The death toll of the 12-story condo collapse in Surfside, Florida, currently stands at 97. Yesterday, the remaining 22 million pounds of debris were removed from the scene, clearing away what was left at the site. The Florida judge commented on the $150 million settlement, saying, quote, "The court's concern has always been the victims here." The sum includes about $50 million in insurance on the condo complex and at least $100 million in proceeds from the sale of the Surfside property where the structure once stood. However, this does not count any proceeds from the many lawsuits that have been already filed. Those lawsuits are being consolidated into a single class action suit that would cover all victims and family members if they choose. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans rejected an effort to begin debating on an infrastructure deal. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer scheduled a procedural vote yesterday to push forward negotiations on the bill that had been dragging along for weeks. He said, quote, "We've waited a month. It's time to move forward." But Republicans used the filibuster to reject the effort, saying that there was still some unresolved issues in the deal. The nearly $1 trillion measure includes about $179 billion in new spending on roads, bridges, water supply, broadband, and other public work projects, a first phase of Biden's infrastructure agenda. Republicans are expected to delay a vote until Monday. Vaccine advisors to the CDC will meet today to address new safety issues concerning the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and to review data on whether vaccine booster shots will be needed in the future. The committee is scheduled to meet from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. today. However, there are no plans for the panel to vote on the issues that will be discussed. The committee plans to review recent data on the cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare condition in which the immune system attacks the nerves. This has been found in a few people who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Though the condition has been labeled as very rare, the committee will discuss ways to address it. Tokyo is now reporting its highest COVID-19 numbers since January, just before the Olympics are planned to start. Today, Tokyo reported 1,970 new infections, sending the city into a state of emergency as the pandemic worsens. With the Games 24 hours away, at least 18 athletes have contracted the virus. Tokyo residents have expressed some concern and anger about the Games and its link to increased COVID-19 cases. A poll by Reuters found that 55% were opposed to the games and 68% doubted that Olympic organizers could contain the spread of the virus in Tokyo. Tokyo's government released a statement saying, quote, "If the increase rates rise further, in less than 2 weeks, we will face a critical situation with the number of infections far exceeding that of the third wave. There is an urgent need to prepare crisis management systems for hospital care, as well as for designated hotels for recovery and at-home recovery." Yesterday, a federal judge blocked the state of Arkansas from enforcing a law that would have banned doctors from providing puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or gender transition surgeries to minors. The law would have been the first of its kind in the nation, but follows a wave of anti-trans legislation. However, this block may just be temporary for now and may be followed up with other legislation. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now.